Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. The first exhibition to focus exclusively on photographs made in the eastern half of the United States during the 19th century, east of the Mississippi, 19th century American landscape photography, showcases some 175 works, from daguerreotypes and stereographs to album imprints and cyanotypes, as well as several photographers whose efforts have often gone unheralded. Mary Panzer shares the story of one photographer, John Moran, 1831 to 1903, brother to painter Thomas Moran, in this lecture held on May 14, 2017 at the National Gallery of Art. John Moran belonged to a network of Philadelphia-based amateur artists, historians, scientists, and collectors who recognized photography as a fine art in the years before the Civil War. Moran also appreciated the art of the newly developed stereograph. After 1865, the art of John Moran disappeared into collections of prints and historic documents, while Philadelphia photographers continued to lead the country in excellence for another generation. East of the Mississippi is on view from March 12th through July 16th, 2017.
John Moran is the first art photographer in America, so why haven't you heard of him? Why did it take us 150 years to give him a show at the National Gallery? First of all, John Moran was born in England and in 1831, died in New York in 1902. But from 1844 to 1891, that's most of his life, he lived in Philadelphia. It was the right time to be a photographer in the city, as you'll be able to see in the first galleries of this exhibition, in fact. But it was the wrong city from history's point of view. Once New Yorkers and Harvard professors began to write the history of the 19th century, Philadelphia's place in the national story faded into the colonial past. After a few generations, collective memory shifts, and we have only the historians to tell us what happened. This system delivers mixed results, and this refrain will echo through our talk today. John Moran believed that photography could be an art at a time when almost nobody agreed with him. After Alfred Stieglitz, a New Yorker, began his crusade at the turn of the 20th century to establish photography as a fine art, he also claimed credit for the idea, at least as practiced in America, and assured everyone that there had been no art photography here before he showed Americans how it was done, and historians took his word for it. In Moran's own era, most people believed that all photography that was not a portrait, with its crisp, shiny, detailed images, some seen in the stereo viewer, belonged to a form of picture making that was ephemeral, educational, anonymous, and ordinary. Thanks to a group of men who valued this kind of homely evidence and were dedicated to preserving memories of Philadelphia's past, Moran's work survived in scrapbooks and albums they deposited at the Library Company. So the time is right for Moran today. Yeah, here he is. This is not Moran, it's a picture of him. The time is right for Moran today. In the 21st century, we have come to value materials that were once discarded and aesthetic values once disdained, and photography of all kinds benefits from our enlightened view. There are many more museum collections, exhibitions, galleries, curators, and collectors than even existed 25 years ago. This exhibition that's here, thanks to Ms. Wagner, Dr. Wagner, this exhibition would have been impossible even 10 years ago. What does Moran have to tell us today? He has good advice on how to make good photographs. His prescient observation that all photographs, good and bad, reflect the opinions and ideas of their makers opens our eyes and makes all photographs more interesting, from your snapshots to magazine advertisements to the exquisite examples that you can find here on the gallery walls. Okay. During the middle of the 19th century, Philadelphia grew big and rich. It quadrupled in size from 1830, a population of 161,000, to 1850, when there were over 400,000, and grew 20% again to 1860, where there were over 530,000 people. Commerce, manufacturing, and finance all contributed to its wealth. There was no kind of product that could not be found in Philadelphia. From textiles to umbrellas and books to bricks, all were made here and sold here. I'm showing you a view of the Centennial Exposition of 1876, which took place in Philadelphia's Fairmount Park. It was part birthday party and part World's Fair. Historian Sam Bass Warner used a metaphor from nature to describe the chaos that came over the city in these years. Speed, bigness, newcomers, and money beat upon settled manners with a rain of harassment and opportunity. The character in the eyes of contemporaries was that, the city character was that of a marketplace. Novelist George Lippard declared the business of buying and selling, turning everything to the best possible account, was stamped in the manners and faces and costumes of its citizens. Even Charles Dickens was infected by the local character when he visited in 1842 and confessed that, quote, thoughts of lodging over against the marketplace and of making a large fortune in corn came over me involuntarily. So you can, it's a busy place. Despite its history of art institutions and exhibitions, art was not at the center of civic life. Yet there was plenty of work for those who were trained to make pictures. National publications like Godey's Lady's Book, which had 1 million readers in 1860 and was one of the largest selling periodicals in the nation, as well as Philadelphia-based competitors Leslie's and Peterson's and Graham's, all called for illustrations, which in turn employed hundreds of artists to make them. Starting in the 1820s, when lithography came to America, the new medium grew to provide early forms of advertising, sheet music, stock certificates, letterhead, insurance policies, labels, and bonds, that is, paper money, quote, so intricate as to prevent counterfeiting, very important when there was no single source of paper money. Another way illustrators circulated their work was through the theater. There was a very active theater community in Philadelphia, from Shakespeare to melodrama to musicals. There had set painters and designers. And you could also purchase art pretty easily. Businesses like James Earl's, this is the second floor, provided mirrors, frames, paintings, and framed colored prints all in one spot. More important, as the city grew, so did a middle class who had time and money to spend as they pleased on all these exciting entertainments. Prosperity and a civic habit of association meant that Philadelphia amateurs pursued numerous subjects without needing academic or professional status. Many studied natural history, which included studying shells and fossils and plants and birds and minerals and microscopic investigations, and they argued in clubs about evolution. They gave lectures. They published their work in journals and sometimes even in the newspaper. Collectors also opened their doors to visitors, whether the collection concerned the signatures of famous men, such as all the signers of the Declaration of Independence, or figures from European royalty, or they could collect old master drawings, rare prints, and paintings. And for some Philadelphians, the city's own history became collectible. It's easy to see how photography flourished in this environment. And as we will see later, this habit or hobby became an important source of income for John Moran. What we have here is Moran's view of the second floor of Independence Hall, where the remnants of Charles Wilson Peale's museum were on display. And you can see the statue of Washington. The oval shapes inside the frames were portraits that the Peale family had done of figures from the Revolutionary War. They'd done them, you know, in person, so this was kind of like pre-photographs of the founding fathers. This was on view in Philadelphia. Some people, and we know about this today, just like shiny new things. They like its difficulty and the seductive wealth of detail and the progress that any practitioner could make when the technology was still new. One such Philadelphian you can see on the left is Robert Cornelius, a manufacturer of brass lighting fixtures, who embraced the new daguerreotype technology and opened the city's and the arguably the nation's first portrait studio in 1840. One of his first clients was John McAllister on the right. Cornelius gave it up very quickly because he couldn't make any money and he went back to business. But around 1860, Philadelphia's photographers formed their own club, and a few years later, the Philadelphia Photographer began publishing as the nation's most serious photography magazine. In the 1860s, Philadelphia engineer Coleman Sellers wrote the regular letter from America to the British Journal of Photography, most important in the world. From his accounts, we can learn a lot about Moran, his colleagues, and his work. In 1863, Sellers reported that a British visitor to Philadelphia noted the pleasure of being a photographer in the city. Thanks to the general harmony among men of science here and the social good feeling which exists, the amateur photographers all have free access to the leading photographic establishments. Professionals admit much progress due to experiments of the amateurs. There are instruments made by every celebrated maker in the world, and the stock of foreign instruments in the hands of the dealers is large. McAllister and brother were one of those dealers, and you can see in this stereo view by John Moran an array of stereo viewers in the foreground of the picture. Suffice it to say, after 2 days among them, I returned home under the full conviction that to attain perfect happiness, a man must have the newest lens, a studio with a skylight, and a pass to photograph in Fairmount Park. Frustratingly little is known about John Moran himself. Here's a landscape he took on Catawissa Island. Like other family photographers, he made many records but rarely appears in them. His mother Mary and her 9 children came from England in 1843, following her husband Thomas Sr., who had emigrated earlier. In 1844, drawn in part by the education available in Philly, the family settled in the Manayunk section of Philadelphia, dominated by textile mills. You can see the mill in the back, and this is the power mills, the beginning of power mills in the front, which meant that a lot of supervisors were able to hire women, and that's why you see many women in this picture once the looms became automated or powered by steam. It was a less grueling job. Thomas Sr. worked as a weaver, as did Edward, the oldest brother. John, Peter, and Thomas all trained as lithographers. The brothers became successful artists. Here's Edward, who became a marine specialist. Thomas was a landscape specialist. Peter was a genre and country views. Sister Sarah married an artist, Stephen Jerome Ferris, and her sons became artists. John appears in local directories as a lithographer in 1856 and a photographer from 1860 through 1885, occasionally listing his profession as artist. This is Thomas's view of the Grand Canyon of the Yellowstone, which was exhibited here in Washington in 1872 and was credited with helping create the national park that we now have today. John, in 1871, participated in the Darien Survey, led by Commodore Selfridge, to survey the Isthmus of Panama in search of a route for the interoceanic canal. This is a survey similar to survey expeditions led by Clarence King and John Wesley Powell and Ferdinand Hayden. In 1871, Thomas accompanied Hayden's survey to Yellowstone, where he was accompanied by William Henry Jackson, a photographer. Jackson's pictures helped Thomas Moran create the landscape we just saw. In 1874, John Moran served as staff photographer on one of the eight American teams to join the international scientific effort to track the transit of Venus across the sun, which would allow scientists to more accurately establish the distance between the Earth and the sun. This image is from a camp in Honolulu. Moran was in Hobart, Tasmania, and it was cloudy that day. So I don't think he was able to bring back much, but the Americans altogether had 300 photographic documents to contribute to this effort. In the 1880s, John Moran was a resident artist of the Arch Street Theater. This is his picture from the late 1860s, which was home to the stage legend Mrs. John Drew, who was grandmother to the movie stars Lionel John and Ethel Barrymore. If we could get close up and see that the placard to either side of the door, you would discover that Mrs. John Drew was starring in She Stoops to Conquer, and Jenny Lind was on the same bill. So it's a very first class theatrical community. By the 1890s, John had joined Edward and Thomas in New York City, where he wrote about art and exhibited watercolors. He was a widower living with his son when he died there in 1902. Thomas, Edward, and Peter studied with local artists who trained in Europe, including, you can see on the right, The Tossed Ship by James Hamilton, who called himself the American Turner, and the German landscape artist Paul Weber, image you can see on the left. Like everyone else at mid-century, they learned about the history of art from print reproductions and original lithographed works of art, and were lucky to have access to Philadelphia's world-class print collections assembled by Samuel Fales, James Claghorn, and Ferriman Rogers, among others. Rogers was an important patron of Thomas Aikens. When travel was still a luxury, and public art collections rare, art history education in Europe, as well as the United States, took place through these monochromatic reproductions of great painting and sculpture. Here you can see Mona Lisa on the right, and the Apollo Belvedere on the left. Moran himself produced photographic copies of painting and sculpture by Philadelphia artists, and this could have been why he took up photography, we don't know. So a brief technical note now. Making photographs took work from 1851 until the late 1870s, roughly the era of Moran's career. Photographers had to prepare their own negatives on sheets of glass, treating them with albumen, AKA egg whites, and light-sensitive chemicals. The negatives went into a plate holder, and you can see the assistant there with his plate holder behind him. And had to go into the camera while still wet, because when they dried, they would no longer be light sensitive. Then you remove the wet negative directly after the exposure, developed it on the spot in a dark tent. Dry negatives could be used to make prints anytime by placing the negatives directly on light sensitive paper, waiting for them to develop an image, then fixing and washing the print. To work outside your studio, you had to transport the chemicals, developing trays, glass plates, and darkroom tent with you. From Coleman Sellers, we know that Moran used glass plates throughout his career in the city, suburbs, and far into the mountains. He reached the Susquehanna Valley, the Allegheny Mountains, the White Mountains, the Delaware Water Gap, and Catawissa Island by traveling on the relatively new railroad lines. The number of lines and miles covered expanded dramatically from 1850 to 1860, making these scenic excursions a fairly new form of entertainment for Americans when the first of Moran's known images emerged in the early 1860s. And the exhibition here addresses that relationship between photography and tourism and the railroad. We know that Moran traveled with his brothers on trips organizing around making pictures. His brothers regularly appear in the photographs. Moran described his method to Coleman Sellers, and I condense several reports here. This very beautiful image is in the show. Mr. Moran has a wonderful knack of taking views just from the right point of view and in the proper light. To catch some of his fine pictures of waterfalls, he camped by them for days at a time and then published one single view, but that one was very beautiful. His artist brothers, too, were with him, and they sketched while he studied and tried the various effects of light and shade. Here's another one. Last summer, Moran passed over the route of the Penn Central Railroad and has added to his collection two volumes of artistic sketches in the Alleghenies. Taken on wet plates, they represent all kinds of subjects. In one, he has pointed his camera at the setting sun, giving us clouds in the air and their reflection in the water of a still lake. Some show glimpses of far-off mountains and rugged foregrounds, while a great many are studies of foreground only, rocks, weeds, and fallen trunks. Let's see what I've got here. One gem is so perfect in every detail that the shape and structure of broad leaves can be studied, while rough but regular bark is given with a Pre-Raphaelite distinctness. It is a picture to be lingered over and does full justice to the pride of the American forest. Mr. Moran returned from the Delaware Water Gap with a rich treat in pictures. A few stereographs of the very large collection he has published are of especial interest. Killing the Snake has all the wild scenery in the distance produced by such a large river as the Delaware carving its way through the mountain range, while in the foreground of rocks and brambles lies coiled the deadly rattlesnake. In the second picture, his snake ship is defunct, and they are deliberately counting the rattles to see how many summers he has crawled along the sticks and stones. An artist's box of colors in the foreground, indicating the call of the two venturesome ones who have made the capture. In 1862, Thomas and John worked together to illustrate a story about the Catawissa Railroad for Harper's Monthly magazine. And Diane knows exactly how excited I was when I found this. Within a decade, illustrated railroad excursion stories had grown predictable and very popular. As staff artist to Scribner's, Thomas Moran regularly illustrated these articles, which promoted industry and railroad travel, accompanied by pictures of the expected sites. Photographers settled in tourist spots like Watkins Glen and produced the expected views for the tourist trade, which continued for decades. By 1872, it appears that George F. Crum, who's got the image on the top, and R.G. Crum and George F. Gates provided Thomas Moran, whose woodcut you see in the background, provided him with very useful guides to spectacular scenery, which he would translate, often with liberal embellishment, into attractive illustrations. This is where Thomas parts company from his brother, John the photographer. John Moran didn't reproduce the expected view. He used his camera to make pictures that could stand on their own as independent works of art. John Moran argued for the relationship of photography to other fine art in careful and cogent essays delivered before the Photographic Society of Philadelphia and published for a national audience in the Philadelphia Photographer magazine. I'm quoting here from three different articles. One problem in Moran's eyes was to show that photography was not condemned by its usefulness. The cathedral, insofar as it is merely useful, is a work of science, but as it addresses the imagination, it is a work of art. However, if art has no function other than to be beautiful, the best, he said, the best and most beautiful photographs may claim the preeminence of being as useless as even the Apollo Belvedere. Moreover, art exists in many varieties. There are relative degrees of excellence, he said, in all modes of art, from Hamlet to Auld Lang Syne, or the Transfiguration to a chalk drawing, there is a wide interval, yet each is a work of art. In photography, he says, as in any work of art, the merit lies in the power of seeing and deciding what shall be done. It is this knowledge of art or art of seeing which gives value and importance to the works of certain photographers over others. There are hundreds who make chemically faultless photographs, he said, but few make pictures. And while Moran understood that photographs made good souvenirs, he knew that photography could achieve more. She can present imagery with a reality and force nearly rivaling the painter and in some respects superior. Moran argued, and today we agree, that all art relies on the artist's imagination. He said, true art in landscape painting is interpretation and not imitation. The artist becomes a brilliant commenter on the book of nature by holding up to our vision harmonies and beauties that are invisible to ordinary mortals. By giving us the power to see beyond our natural vision, he is, in an ideal sense, a creator. So where does one acquire the power to see the beautiful? By looking, and now this is, and John Moran actually in his essays let us know. He said, look at the way artists have done it in the past. Look at the forms of art that is most like your own, that is, monochromatic, made on paper, and made to be reproduced in multiple, i.e. prints. Moran provided a short list of artists whose prints he asked aspiring art photographers to seek out. Here's the engraved works of Rembrandt and Turner I esteem as of the most value and which are accessible. That meant lots of people collected them. You could find them. So I wanted to show you, here's a Three Houses Along a Road by Rembrandt. And here is the Kittatinning Point that we were just looking at. And I think you can see how he's borrowed things from Rembrandt in terms of how to fill the sky with detail, what to use the trees, how to arrange your image, how to fill up your foreground, how to do a contrast between shadows and light, so that he's learning from the masters. Another person he mentions is Turner, whose engraved works, this is from Liber Studiorum, which a series of sites that you could go to see, and Thomas and Edward actually did go track Turner's path in this. So here's a abbey in ruins. This is Benjamin West's house, the painter. I want you to look through the window, through the door, out the back door to the tree that's growing behind the house, and then see how he's borrowed this same strategy from Turner, who used the arches of the ruined abbey to reveal what's going on behind. Also, the way the shadows fall on the front of the house, you can see the shadow falling there above the little figure on the left side of the screen. So he's picking up tips from other artists. He also referred to near contemporaries. He said there are many lithographs of the French painters interesting from their lighting. Among the best of those are Rousseau, this is Theodore Rousseau, Jules Dupré, and Richard Bonington. Thoreau, this is actually a painting, and Dupré belonged to a school of artists who worked in the forest of Fontainebleau, beginning in the 1830s and continuing into the 1860s. The forest comprised over 42,000 acres of woods surrounding a 16th century royal palace. There were villages at the border that housed farmers and workmen, and the village of Barbizon became the artist's headquarters and gave its name to this aesthetic movement. In the 1830s, the choice to work outside, to work in their own country, not in Italy, and to choose a humble genre without heavy narrative significance comprised a kind of artistic rebellion. By the 1860s, the Barbizon school was both modern and widely accepted. Rousseau was the longest resident and faithful guide to fellow artists. Thanks to spreading railroads and hospitable villages and the art itself, tourists from nearby Paris descended on Fontainebleau. And when Thomas and Edward Morin traveled to Europe in 1862, they too visited Barbizon, by then a standard stop on the art tourists' itinerary. Today, we are also aware that photographers accompanied the Barbizon artists into the forest, but we don't know whether John Morin knew their work. Morin endorsed Barbizon's school for more than just subject matter. These artists made lithographs. This is one by Jules Dupré. Lithographs were drawn with a greasy crayon on a piece of smooth limestone, which was then inked and printed, making a drawing that could be repeated many times over, much the way a negative can be make many photographs. In addition, thanks to the monochromatic medium, artist and photographer were working with the same materials, light and shade. The artist manipulates the density of the ink, the photographer the density of his negative. Morin's advice to photographers encouraged them to think in terms of light rather than subject matter. So he said, "Seek out situations where the light is low, as in times of heavy fog. If a subject can be found that is broad in its masses and strong in its lines of contrast and local color, for instance, when masses of rock in the bed of a stream are so arranged as to be thrown boldly against deep masses of shadow, the exposure can be long enough to get detail in the dark places, give force of light to the rocks, while the hazy sky will not be too bright, and the most beautiful aerial effects can be produced." He said, "Showery weather is also favorable for the best effects on foliage. Where the subject is one of dark and gloomy character, this result comes, of course, from the greater reflective power of the leaves when covered with moisture. Every morning and evening are favorable for exposing. In short, those uncertain and doubtful times of light are those in which one may get, by proper judgment, the most unique results." So this is called Sunset After Rain. This is what he's talking about. Morin also mentions Richard Parkes Bonington, who lived from 1802 to 1828, and who spent his tragically short artistic career in Paris, where he roomed with Delacroix and contributed lithographs to the early volumes of the monumental 20-volume series Voyage Pittoresque et Romantique, published between 1820 and 1878 by Baron Isidore Taylor and Charles Nodier, made to create a visual record of the historic national landscape and architecture of France. The series title, the term picturesque, emerged at the end of the 18th century. Its subjects included old buildings in decay or ruin, landscape populated by timeless rural figures, all rendered in contrasts of light and shadow. Anything related to progress and industry was notably absent from these views. Eventually, the conventions became very trite and silly late in the 19th century. But early on, in Bonington's hands, this style gave sparkling life to the old and neglected landscape and architecture he pictured. By depicting mundane details alongside powerful works of architecture, this is from the street of in Rouen, the viewer moves easily from a serious historic tableau, which is this 15th, 16th century structure. So we've got this very powerful work of architecture, and then you also have the spontaneity of the street scene, people moving up and down their ordinary life. The contrast, as Nodier describes, conveys a kind of surprise in it, as if art had caught nature unawares. And this contrast between the everyday and the historic, between the dark and the light, between mundane and, you know, spectacular, these kind of contrasts, more than the subject matter, characterizes the experience of the picturesque. Heightened perception, a self-conscious pleasure in the art of observation, appreciation of beauty found in the ordinary and the local. In this way, the picturesque was more than a way to make pictures. It was like a lens. By looking through it, a viewer could see what had otherwise been invisible. So we can see how Moran learned from Bonington. On the here's our street in Rouen, and on the left is 114-116 Water Street in Philadelphia. If you see on the right, you can see a shadow, which is the ghost of a wagon that stayed and then moved on while everything else was standing still. So Moran's oblique view of 114 and 116 South Water Street exploits the same vivid contrast between elegant architectural facade and the busy, mundane, mercantile character of life on the street that Bonington found in Rouen 40 years earlier. A harmonious resolution of present and past distinguishes both these images. Moran preserves a delicate rhythmic balance between dark and light, paying attention to the contrast in texture between brick and wood and paving stone and broom straw, making a wide range of information clear and comprehensible, from shop signs to the assortment of building types, each with its distinctive windows and doors and roofline. I always wondered whether he'd been up and down inside every single building and was moving the shutters so that they would be exactly where he wanted them to be. Moran's images devoting to historic relics tell a different story. And we saw Benjamin West's house too, which here we again see his sense of humor with the tree through the building, and choosing a period of time of day when these shadows are going to be making these diagonal shapes across the front of the building, positioning the tree so that the sky is actually filled and is not blank and dull. The house in Mickle's Court was serving as a stable when Moran found it around 1867. It had been built in the mid-1770s as a sailmaker's shop. In 1895, this is where Quaker Ann Parrish opened the, quote, House of Industry, which gave women paid employment, the first such charitable organization established in America. The institution outgrew its first home, but its origins were left to neglect. Moran's photograph tells this story. Similarly, Moran preserved a view of the Pennsylvania Bank and contemporary carelessness toward history. Built in 1798, architectural historians now consider it to have inspired the colonial revival style associated with Philadelphia architecture for the first half of the 19th century. Moran arrived on the scene while demolition was underway. An institution that once represented security and wealth now stands a useless ruin. Lounging workmen and theater bills plastered on the fence in the foreground cannot diminish the sense of a building defined by its absence, with six elegant columns that support no weight. Moran's images have no single meaning. He can communicate both admiration for the past, disdain for the present in a single record. This complex vision distinguishes his best work. Moran, in all of his writings, does not mention the final and most purely photographic influence on his work and vision, which is the art of seeing through the stereograph. Those twin images, with slight differences that when mounted on cards and seen in a viewer, duplicate the illusion of seeing a view in three dimensions. And you can see two of John Moran's stereos in the exhibition in little viewer, so you can see how they work. By far, the majority of stereo views deliver the simple thrill of seeing into space. This one is off the edge of the Brooklyn Bridge looking towards Manhattan, I think. Certain common characteristics of stereo intensify the illusion. An object close to the viewer sets up the thrill of sweeping into deep space. A different shape offers a goal or destination to lead our eye from front to back. We look straight ahead, moving easily from near to far. This form of illusion was especially popular in the United States. Its influence shows up in American landscape painting by Edward Bierstadt and Thomas Moran, among others, where the composition reflects stereo rendering of foreground, middle ground, and background to contribute to the illusionistic depiction of deep space and sweeping views. When John Moran composed for the stereo viewer, he deliberately forced our eye to zig and zag through space. In images such as these, we work to move from front to back. Our eyes move through the picture the way they move in the act of looking at nature itself. And as we know, since Coleman Sellers told us, Moran carefully selected and timed his views so that the moment we enjoy in his stereo photograph is undoubtedly more beautiful than the sight we could find on our own. Moran's three-dimensional approach to composition equally informs his non-stereo compositions, and in fact, he issued some images in both formats, single and stereo. But many interesting examples have much less meaning when seen without a viewer. In a viewer, the tangle of branches, let's see if I've got a tangle of branches here. You can see, all right, without a viewer, it's really difficult to see how these different levels of space distinguish themselves. But in a viewer, you see now a three-dimensional space, intersecting lines that build together. The hazy bands of foliage in the middle distance emerge as distinctive levels of space and full of visual interest. However, a stereo view is very difficult to see today outside generous gallery exhibitions like these, or in the context of a library where both cards and viewers can be used, such as at the Division of Prints and Photographs at the Library of Congress. Moreover, they are difficult to exhibit on a wall or in a lecture hall where I wish I could distribute 3D glasses for everyone, and also, though we're looking at these very big today, as you know, they're very little, and little is not the style of contemporary art. There's some branches. More importantly, for historians of art, this art of illusion directly contradicts one of the strongest principles of modern art, to celebrate the move towards abstraction and to value the two-dimensional depiction of light and line over any effort to recreate the illusion of three-dimensional space on a flat piece of paper or canvas. I'm grateful to be a 21st century citizen of the postmodern era at a time when we are able to recover much that the 20th century moderns disdained, including the 3D vision of John Moran. More than one critic has remarked on the way photography as a picture-making process emerged to fit the needs of his time. Lady Elizabeth Eastlake, friend of photographers and wife of Sir Charles Eastlake, the first president of the London Photographic Society, wrote anonymously in 1857 for the London Quarterly Review, essentially their New York Review of Books. Like John Moran, Lady Eastlake made photography female. This is another one of John Moran's views of an 18th century building on down near the harbor. You can see that there's a fish proprietor on the right. She, photography, is made for the present age in which the desire for art resides in a small minority, but the craving, or rather necessity, for cheap, prompt, and torrent facts resides in the public at large. Photography is the purveyor of such knowledge to the world. She is the sworn witness of everything presented to her view. What are her unerring records in the service of mechanics, engineering, geology, and natural history, but facts of the most sterling and stubborn kind? What are her representations of the bed of the ocean and the surface of the moon, of the launch of the Marlborough, and of the contents of the Great Exhibition, of Charles Kean's now destroyed scenery of The Winter's Tale, and of Prince Albert's now slaughtered prize ox? But the facts, which are neither the province of art nor of description, but of that new form of communication between man and man, neither letter, message, nor picture, which now happily fills up the space between them. Lady Eastlake neatly sidestepped the question that so many people wanted to answer. Was photography art? Not exactly. McAllister's. I'll go back. This is Lady Eastlake. In this sense, no photographic picture that was ever taken in heaven or earth or in the waters underneath the earth of anything or scene, however defective when measured by an artistic scale, is destitute of a special and what we might call an historic interest. Every form which is traced by light is the impress of one moment or one hour or one age in the great passage of time. Though the faces of our children may not be modeled and rounded with that truth and beauty which art attains, yet minor things, the very shoes of the one, the inseparable toy of the other, are given with a strength of identity which art does not even seek. Though the view of a city can be deficient in those niceties of reflected lights and harmonious gradations which belong to the facts of which art takes account, yet the facts of the age and of the hour are there. For we count the lines in that keen perspective of telegraph wire and read the characters on the playbills or manifesto destined to be torn down on the morrow. Moran's work survived largely because it met the needs of a peculiar group of historians, amateurs again, including the lens maker John McAllister, whose shop you see again here, Charles Colson and John Fanning Watson, and their colleagues at the Library Company, who were determined to preserve records of everyday life of the present and the recent past at a time when such subjects, quote, would not suit the gravity and dignity of common history, unquote. At the beginning of this talk, I mentioned Philadelphia's chaotic growth in mid-century and how it inspired a number of men to preserve evidence about the city's past. They were led by John McAllister, whom we've already met, who inherited the family firm dealing in scientific instruments, which had been operating since the mid-1770s. He collected books and documents of all kind, his taste running into, quote, local antiquities, ancient pamphlets, newspapers, maps, and manuscripts, and photographs. His voluminous collections came to the library company. Charles Poulsen, son of a newspaper editor, devoted himself to mineralogy, ornithology, and 18th century Philadelphia, assembled dozens of scrapbooks with clippings and articles and prints, and commissioned images of the historical city, quote, that would have otherwise been entirely strange to the rising generation. He sent photographers Frederick DeBorge Richards, Richards made this picture, and James McLeese to record buildings on sites endangered by expansion. His carefully captioned scrapbooks came to the library company in 1866. The final person, John Fanning Watson, who was born in 1779 and died in 1860, practically as old as the nation, was the most charming and influential of these Philadelphia historians. Poulsen traded Watson almost as his own relic. This is a picture of Watson's house. The house wasn't particularly old, but the site was very old. And in lieu of a picture of Watson, we have his house commissioned by Poulsen. Watson's mission was to rescue from the ebbing tide of oblivion all those fugitive memorials and unpublished facts and observations or reminiscences and traditions which could best illustrate the domestic history of our former days. Watson trusted eyewitnesses and primary sources. He interviewed the oldest people he could find and filled his scrapbooks with bits of fabric from dresses worn in the 18th century and scraps of wallpaper and bits of wood chipped from trees that had stood in important places. Quote, the historian must labor to bring back to the imagination things which none can any longer see. He must generate the idea presence and learn to communicate with men and matters of other times. His published annals appeared in 1830, 1842, and 1856, and the scrapbooks that supported them are now on deposit at the library company. None of this sentiment, however, stopped the builders. In 1869, Hugh Davids, a Philadelphian amateur historian, amateur photographer, amateur naturalist, art collector, and a disciple of John Ruskin, wrote about the city's architecture as a treasure endangered by the American habit of looking forward, not back. Quote, we shall leave no records for posterity. Each age builds for the succeeding one to destroy. And what few remains we have of our early national life are fast disappearing under the vandal of irreverence, lust of gain, and love of change of the present day. While Davids was writing, John Moran was using his camera to remedy this catastrophe. In June of 1870, Moran sold an album of 79 views to the library company. There's the library company. As it appeared in about 1869 when he made the picture. He sold an album of 79 views to the library company celebrating historic structures showing what would soon vanish. True to Bonington, his views are laden with contrast, flickering light, mundane detail, modern citizens who stand in matter-of-fact relationship to the colonial past. You have seen several of these views today. Moran was rediscovered in the late 1970s by curators Bernard Riley, Kenneth Finkel of the Library Company, and dealers and collectors such as Marion Carson, Russell Norton, and William Schaefer, and Leonard Wally, newly alert to the way his photographs could convey more than the appearance of an old building or a pretty mountain view in stereo. They were among the first historians to recognize this once flourishing time and place for American photography. Many of the images they collected can be found in this exhibition, and we have a large number of them here in Washington, thanks to Mrs. Carson, who decided not to follow the Philadelphia history tradition, and she left her vast collection to the Library of Congress. So we've got escaped from Philadelphia. As Moran promised, The ideas an artist photographer brings to the scene will shape what he sees and what his work reveals to the viewer, for good and bad. The feelings and perceptions of the photographer will inevitably find their way into his work or her work. The boredom of the DMV camera operator comes through in the terrible picture on your driver's license. The uninhibited enchantment you feel with your first child's every step shows up in your snapshots. Moran's generous effort to create a landscape of surprising, intimate beauty gives his work a lovely intensity that few of his contemporaries could match. He believed it could be art, and art is a matter of the artist, not the medium he chooses. So I'm going to give Moran the last word. Art, in all its forms, is the form of thought, and the photographic work which rises to this plane is the expression of the ideas of the photographer. Nature becomes plastic to his touch, and he molds her to his judgment through his power to see the beautiful. All this so-called beauty and grandeur of nature is but the measure of the human mind. It is the mind that gilds and beautifies this world of ours. A mind with a camera. Thank you very much.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.